This is all theater. This is all just political theater.
Political theater. Political theater.
Pure political
theater.
Theater.
Political theater.
The nefarious,
significant, and protracted
political theater for political theater's sake.
I yield back.
From Washington, this is Political Theater. Roll Call's review of the spectacle of politics on Capitol Hill and across the country. I'm Jason Dick. The United States and Russia have a tense political relationship. President Joe Biden has called Russian leader Vladimir Putin a killer. Putin replied that it takes one to know one. The two countries are at odds over cyber hacking, election interference, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and scores of other issues, including Russia's strong backing for Belarus, which hijacked a commercial airliner recently so it could arrest a dissident journalist. That's a lot of baggage for the upcoming summit between Biden and Putin on June 16th in Switzerland. And yet, things have been worse, only to have cooler heads prevail. Consider the world's close call when the U.S. and Soviet Union almost got into a nuclear war during the 1963 Cuban Missile Crisis. The politics of the time almost drove us to oblivion. But the very human relationship between two men, one a British businessman and one a high-ranking Soviet officer, helped avert catastrophe where the politics were just making things worse. That relationship is the subject of the new espionage thriller, The Courier, starring Benedict Cumberbatch as Greville Wynn, an unlikely British liaison with Colonel Oleg Petkovsky, who supplied him and the West with the intelligence needed for the United States to help defuse the Cuban situation. Dominic Cook, who directed and produced the movie, joins us on Political Theater today to discuss the film, which is out in theaters already and will be released on Blu-ray, DVD, and streaming June 1st. Dominic Cook, welcome to Political Theater.
Thanks very much, Jason. It's good to be here.
Let's do a quick recap of the movie. It's contained within a few years. It's not just about the Cuban Missile Crisis, but it is about this real-life figure, Greville Wynn, who, by the way, I know he's a real figure, but you probably couldn't come up with a more British name than that,
right.
I think. But let's do a quick little recap, and then we'll talk about how you got involved in the project.
Well, it's really the story of how, it's a true story, but like any movie, there's a certain amount of sort of compression of information. It all happened. And Greville Wynn was a salesman. He was sort of an engineer by trade, and he was selling sort of factory equipment to the Eastern Bloc. That was he had a business, and that's what he did. And because he was traveling there, MI6 and CIA had got together because they had a contact from this guy, Oleg Petkovsky, who was the most senior, as it turned out, in the whole Cold War. He was the most senior Russian spy. He was a war hero. He was very closely connected to Khrushchev and all the sort of senior military figures. He was a GRU officer. So he had a lot of access to information, and he did not like the Soviet system. He did not like the way he'd been sort of thwarted personally within that system. And he wanted to sort of get this information out to the West. And MI6 and CIA had a few disasters in Moscow with sort of operatives being found and shot. And so they wanted to find a civilian. And because Greville Wynn had such a sort of perfect cover, and reason for being there, they chose him. And it turned out this coincided with Khrushchev's sort of aggressive turn towards America by putting the missiles into Cuba. And so they ended up bringing back really important information. I mean, not just that, there were 5,000 papers that came out of sort of the military, sector, but the key bits of information were the ones that made it back to Kennedy, which really said, really sort of proved that A, they were taking missiles in, and B, that their nuclear arsenal was way, way smaller than they'd said. So that actually the US did have the sort of strategic advantage, which gave Kennedy the sort of ability to call their bluff.
Right.
So they played a really important role, sort of inadvertently initially, with, sort of putting an end to the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was a really close call for the world. As many people know, we came very close to a nuclear war at that point.
We were really at the brink. And it's, I think that sometimes, we're in the middle of another sort of smaller incident by comparison with the Russians and the Belarusians. Belarus diverted a plane from Ireland and arrested a dissident journalist, Vladimir Putin, Russia's president, who's been a thorn in the side of the West for decades now, is meeting with Alexander Lukashenko, the Belarusian president, today as we're speaking on this podcast. This will be published a little later. The EU is trying to figure out what to do. So we're not exactly in a cold war, but we are in this tense situation, and it seems to be that like this episode that you cover in this film, this feature film, it's given more resonance to by the fact that we continue to have these flare ups with the Eastern Bloc.
Yeah, I mean I actually spent a lot of time in Russia over the years. I've done a lot of playwriting workshops over there. And I also extraordinarily went on a school trip to the Soviet Union in 1983, which is sort of etched in my memory. I was studying, when I was sort of 17, studying for my history exams, sort of Stalin and the whole history of the Cold War. And I've been back, yes, as I said, a lot of times. And then I went back, I haven't been for about 10 years, and then we went to cast this movie. And it's very notable, the change in the last 10 years. I mean, I felt that in the previous visits I'd made, after Perestroika had settled and, the new sort of regime had taken root, that it was much more sort of like a Western country in its sort of skepticism around power, if you like, amongst the people that I met, who were the sort of liberal intelligentsia, admittedly. It wasn't a sort of very broad sector. But when I went back this time, I really noticed the sort of hardening of attitude, a sort of paranoia, really, amongst the same group of people, especially towards the Brits, because at that point, we were involved in this thing in Salisbury where, there was a poisoning. And actually, because Trump was in at that point, there was much more sort of there's a sort of softening towards the US, yes. And a kind of phase of softening towards the US, and a massive sort of loathing of the UK. And we were sort of it was very interesting and slightly sad, really, to see this. What I felt was a sort of regression back to those fault lines, which seemed at some point to be possibly shifting and moving, and a sort of loosening of that hold of the state on people's access to information and their imaginations, which were, of course, very present in the Soviet era.
And before we get to talking a little bit about the big star of your movie, Benedict Cumberbatch, and his role, his co-star, the one who plays Oleg Penkovsky, Mirab
Ninitsa, very close.
Ninitsa.
Yeah.
He was born in what was then the Soviet Union, and is now Georgia, the Republic of Georgia. What were some of the, that seems to loan, like some real gravitas to his role, because he could speak Russian, and also just he grew up in under the shadow of this. Talk about, your casting of him, because it's a really powerful role that he has.
Well, I sort of have to thank my financiers, Film Nation, for sort of just bearing with me, because we'd cast Benedict. I don't think we'd cast Rachel Brosnahan, but we'd cast Benedict.
From the marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yes. Who's a joy. She's brilliant.
She's the CIA contact.
She's fabulous. But we had cast Benedict, and that's how we sort of got our finance unlocked. That's the way it works in movies. You sort of have to have your sort of key box office names in there to sort of unlock the finance. And, initially there was this sort of sense, it's a wonderful role, Penkovsky, that it will be good if I went for a well-known US or UK name. And of course, there are lots of brilliant actors. But the problem I have initially was that they've got to speak in Russian quite a lot, And then also, actually, my experience of having travelled there quite a lot is that Russian, or not necessarily Russian, that part of the world, there is a very, very different sort of outlook. And trying to find that with a Brit or an American, I just thought was probably not the best way to go. So they let me go off to Russia with our casting director, Nina. We went to Moscow and we met with all the sort of great and the good of Russian acting, because there were some other Russian-speaking roles that we cast out of Moscow. I had seen Mira in a TV show called Mafia, where he played the sort of real baddie, and he was absolutely spectacular. And initially we met him for the head of the KGB. But he was so brilliant that we got him back, and he read so extraordinarily that the Film Nation just went, yeah, he's so good, we've got to have him. So they were great. They were great. They got it. And the thing is, what was so interesting about Mirab was that he grew up in, he's an amazing guy, actually. He's brilliant. But, and he now lives in, he's very sort of international. He now lives in Vienna, but he grew up in Soviet Union in Georgia. But he has, as a Georgian, sort of a distance. So on one hand, he absolutely understood the USSR. He lived in it. He grew up in it. On the other hand, he's not Russian. So it was sort of accessible to him, this role. It was sort of, he could see both inside and outside, which I think was really helpful for him, because a lot of Russians, Penkovsky was sort of public enemy number one in the USSR for many, many years, and the Soviet state used him. They did a public show trial, they put it on TV. There was a very influential documentary about him, which sort of defamed him and lied about his achievements in the war and all sorts of things. So a lot of Russians to this day believe him to be not only a traitor, but a sort of awful human being. And so I think if I'd have had a Russian, I might have had quite a sort of long period of trying to sort of wean them off some of those ideas about the character, because you have to sort of identify with the character. You don't necessarily have to love them, but you have to identify with the character if you're going to play them well. And with Mirab, I did have that sort of, he was able to do that. He sort of saw the whole situation.
And it is a great role. And he had some experience in playing in Homeland too, which got a lot of U.S. Audiences. He was Mirov. And you mentioned that Benedict Cumberbatch was able to, I mean, when you sign somebody of his sort of stature and stardom, you know, a lot of the money sort of falls into place. You'd worked with him before, correct, on Hollow Crown, which was a series about Shakespeare's histories. He played Richard III, talk about a meaty role for a British actor. But he also, I mean, yes, he is part of some of the biggest film franchises in the world. He plays Doctor Strange in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He's in the Star Trek, you know, universe playing Khan. He's got a resume that brings money with it, but he's got a thing for espionage too. He was in the remake of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy as Peter Quillam, Smiley's sort of right-hand man. And he was also in, he played Alan Turing in The Imitation Game. And then of course, it's not really a spy, it's more of a detective, but he was Sherlock. he seems to have a thing for these roles, for these juicy British espionage roles.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the things he's brilliant at, and you know, not everyone is sort of being able to play another period authentically. Because I mean, when you look at the way people, when you watch the video of people talking, especially Brits, sort of in the early 60s, they're like an alien species. I mean, they are so different. And you know, even the Brits are reserved people. It's sort of the culture, and I think it comes from the sort of colonial, you know, ruling the empire. So don't show them what you're feeling, sort of thing. And that's sort of been passed down through the population. But they're still like that now to some degree. But they're a world away from how they were at that time, and they were sort of like Edwardians. I mean, it's so extraordinary to see how stiff and sort of reserved and unexpressive people from the sort of mid-century were. But I think in order to play it effectively, you've got to be able to sort of access real feeling underneath it, because they weren't just the surface. There was a lot going on under the surface. I think Benedict is really good at that. And I think if you're playing espionage, you have to be able to sort of mask things. You know, they did. If you were working in that world, you have to be able to hide your real feelings. But he can sort of find a way of letting that through and showing what a person is feeling underneath. And one of the things that I really liked about this when I came across the script, and I thought was quite unusual, was that it sort of shows you a bit more about the personal cost for someone involved in an operation like this. You know, how much lying they have to do, how much deception they have to do of their families, and how a risk they are. And, you know, I think the combination of sort of being at that level of, you know, responsibility with being a rookie was quite an interesting mix for him to play. And so he was very sort of comfortable with playing both those sides. And actually, when we were shooting, a lot of the time it was like, am I showing too much? Am I not showing enough? Those were sort of the questions that came up most frequently.
One thing that also occurs to me about these two men and their friendship is that there's a line that I believe Penkovsky states that Wynn's son, that when the son asks, like, do the Russians hate us? And he says, the Russians don't hate you. Our politicians hate your politicians, and your politicians hate our politicians. And then you have on this human level, this very human level, two people really, as you said, like averting a global catastrophe. And to me, I mean, not to get too, weepy about it, but like that is kind of inspiring, particularly in the kind of darker political times we're in right now, where each side is continually casting aspersions upon the other side, Democrats, Republicans, however it may be, Russians, Brits, and that there's a lack of recognition of people's humanity, which is amplified, I think, by social media, Twitter in particular, Facebook. That's kind of, inspiring. I mean, again, this is a spy movie. This is a thriller. But it does have that message. And I wonder too if that's like a message for us now, because let's face it, we're still in a pandemic. We're still in a very dangerous time in our history. And the politics are kind of failing us at this point.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it has a darkness, the film, but it's a sort of, I think, very positive film. And it's partly about how, as you say, it's possible for one or two people to begin to change things. And it's also partly about the nature of heroism and what that means, and that sort of certain amount of sacrifice and depth of relationship is what makes life meaningful. And I sort of feel like Greta Wynn, at the end of the movie, he's lost a lot, but he's sort of found something very profound, which he's done something of immense value. And really, the thing he did that was of most value was sort of make a proper, profound commitment to another human being, albeit a friend in this instance. And through that friendship, they sort of did something amazing. So I mean, I agree with you, but I've had some extraordinary experiences in Russia, and the people there are so hospitable, so warm. I mean, I've met some brilliant people, and I've been. I once did a really rather extraordinary play written by my director, a young man from the Urals. And he'd never even been to a theatre, but he had a sort of inspirational teacher who sort of inspired him. I was working at the Royal Court Theatre in London, and we did a programme in Russia. And I went over to see, the play was all set in his town, which was a town that had suffered so badly at the hands of sort of post-perestroika. Everyone there wanted communism to come back. I mean, without exception, because what had happened is that they had had full employment, good healthcare, good education, and they'd gone from that to a place run by gangsters, sort of 20% employment, alcoholism absolutely rife. I mean, the lives there were very, very hard. But his family, it was really quite in the middle of nowhere. It was the beginning of Siberia, huge sort of industrial wasteland. And his family were just unbelievable. I mean, they spent the whole day cooking for us and bringing us into their homes, giving them everything they had. People in Russia are very like that. And, it's sad because you sort of think the sort of enmity that's been built up and is still very much there between the nations, the sort of misinformation that is fed to people about in Russia, about the West and here about Russia. And it's just tragic because when you do connect, what you're talking about, the sort of common humanity is very much in evidence. And they're just a very warm people. And, part of it's about that, how relationships sort of bridge all that rubbish, all that nonsense, and become something much, much more important, much more, much stronger,
Well, and I certainly think your film does that. I guess the kind of tagline could be come for the Benedict Cumberbatch and stay for the actual human relationships that develop. Mm-hmm. So, Dominic Cook, thank you so much for joining us on Political Theater and talking about your movie. Good luck with it. I know it's getting streaming and home release and so forth. And it's a good yarn. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks. Cheers.